Good morning. My name is Michael McCusker. Tuesday, December the 1st, was World AIDS Day. I commemorate the memory of Ken Taylor, who died of AIDS with quiet courage and dignity 20 years ago on an unquiet Halloween day, 1995. And Katrin Bridget Snow's birthday was yesterday. She was KMUN program director in the station's early years and was known as Cat Snow on National Public Radio in Salt Lake City and San Francisco for several years afterward. I have lost track of her, so perhaps she might hear this post-natal day tribute swirling through the ether wherever she is. I dedicate today's program to a small green Oregon frog I nearly killed and severely crippled by my unthinking carelessness. Magnifying from the micro to the macro, more than one-third of the world's frogs have disappeared, and the rest are endangered by the careless biodegradation of the planet by our careless species. This program is about global warming and the United Nations Conference on Climate Change that is being held in Paris this week and next, ending on Friday, December 11th. I suppose I ought to utter a disclaimer because a part of the program is my own personal rant. So a portion hereof is my opinion, but certainly not mine only on this cosmic planet quite a few of us judiciously venerate as Biosphere Gaia. I will start with an article by Richard W. Spinrad and Ian Boyd, Our Deadened Carbon-Soaked Seas. Ocean and coastal waters around the world are beginning to tell a disturbing story. The seas, like a sponge, are absorbing increasing amounts of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, so much so that the chemical balance of our oceans and coastal waters is changing and a growing threat to marine ecosystems. Over the past 200 years, the world's oceans and seas have absorbed more than 150 billion metric tons of carbon from human activities. Currently, that's a worldwide average of 150 pounds per person a week, enough to fill a coal train long enough to encircle the equator 13 times every year. We can't see this massive amount of carbon dioxide that's going into the ocean, but it dissolves in seawater as carbonic acid, changing the water's chemistry at a rate faster than seen for millions of years. Known as ocean acidification, this process makes it difficult for shellfish, corals, and other marine organisms to grow, reproduce, and build their shells and skeletons. About 10 years ago, ocean acidification nearly collapsed the $117 million West Coast shellfish industry, which supports more than 3,000 jobs. Ocean currents pushed acidified water into coastal areas, making it difficult for baby oysters to use their limited energy to build protective shells. In effect, the crop was nearly destroyed. Human health, too, is a major concern. In the laboratory, many harmful algal species produce more toxins and bloom faster in acidified waters. A similar response in the wild could harm people eating contaminated shellfish and sicken, even kill, fish and marine mammals such as sea lions. Increasing acidity is hitting our waters along with other stressors. The ocean is warming. In many places, the oxygen critical to marine life is decreasing. Pollution from plastics and other materials is pervasive, and in general, we overexploit the resources of the ocean. Each stressor is a problem, but all of them affecting the oceans at one time is cause for great concern. For both the developing and developed world, the implications for food security, economies at all levels, and vital goods and services are immense. This year, the first nationwide study showing the vulnerability of the $1 billion U.S. shellfish industry to ocean acidification revealed a considerable list of at-risk areas. In addition to the Pacific Northwest, these areas include Long Island Sound, Narragansett Bay, Chesapeake Bay, the Gulf of Mexico, and areas off Maine and Massachusetts. Already at risk are Alaska's fisheries, which account for nearly 60% of the United States commercial fish catch and support more than 100,000 jobs. Ocean acidification is weakening coral structures in the Caribbean and in cold water coral reefs found in the deep waters off Scotland and Norway. In the past 3 decades, the number of living corals covering the Great Barrier Reef have been cut in half, reducing critical habitat for fish and the resilience of the entire reef system. Dramatic change is also apparent in the Arctic, where the frigid waters can hold so much carbon dioxide that nearby shelled creatures can dissolve in the corrosive conditions, affecting food sources for indigenous people, fish, birds, and marine mammals. Clear pictures of the magnitude of changes in such remote ocean regions are sparse. To better understand these and other hotspots, more regions must be studied. We cannot yet predict exactly how ocean acidification will affect conditions among the world's many different marine organisms, but we do know the consequences will be profound. Research already points to the unnatural behavior of coral clownfish in an acidified environment. These fish wander further from their natural protection, making them more vulnerable to predators. We have yet to learn how salmon and other commercially important fish will adapt as acidification erodes their food supply, especially since some of the most vulnerable species are the small, simple life forms that juvenile salmon and other fish depend on. There may be cascading impacts that we don't yet fully understand. Acidification will upset the balance among the multitudes of microscopic life found in every drop of seawater. Such changes will almost certainly affect seafood supplies and the ocean's ability to store pollutants, including future carbon emissions. To understand where the challenge is, we need better ocean measuring capability, linked with improved modeling of marine ecological systems. Smart investments in monitoring and observing are critical to building resilience and hedging risks that can directly affect economies at all levels. There is urgency to such investments. The U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration conducts round-the-clock monitoring of global CO2. The rate of increase has never been higher than during the past 3 years, accelerating the ocean acidification process. And while ocean acidification is a global concern, inroads are occurring at the local scale, encouraging control, for example, of nutrient pollution that can exacerbate acidification. When it comes to the health of the sea, we are all stakeholders. The ocean is a harbinger of our own well-being and the resilience and economic viability of our planet. We ignore the risks of ocean acidification at our own peril and that of future generations. And that was by Richard W. Spinrad, who is the chief scientist of the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and Ian Boyd, who is the chief scientific advisor to the British government's Department of Environment, Food, and Rural Affairs. And now, Our Vanishing Flowers by Stephen L. Buckman. Ours is one of the most colorful relationships of history. We need flowers for our very survival, and in turn, flowers, the plants that exist as crop cultivators or horticultural cut flowers for potted beauties, rely on us to reproduce and spread. But all is not well in this storied partnership. We who behold or nurture flowers are condemning their wild relatives to extinction at an alarming rate, and the world is quickly becoming a lesser place without them. Our prehistoric ancestors certainly made use of flowering plants. Imagine an early human forager 200,000 years ago, a woman walking from her camp searching for edible leaves, fleshy berries, tubers, and hard seeds. She is a keen observer of nature, noticing and remembering when food plants and animals were scarce or abundant. Patches of flowering plants beckon as colorful and scented beacons in otherwise drab monotones of brown earth and green vegetation. Because of her past associations with flowers, she will return to the patch in a few weeks when the tasty berries have ripened. She knows what many moderns have forgotten, that flowers are the harbingers of the fruits and seeds that sustain and keep us healthy. Flowers are relative newcomers. Only recently in the Earth's 4.5 billion year history have they adorned special plants. For most of the distant past, except for the colors of male birds, butterflies, and other insects, fish, and lizards, the above-ocean world was an expanse of brown and red soils and rocks and green forests, savannas, and meadows. Then something extraordinary happened. About 130 to 160 million years ago, the group of plants we know as angiosperms invented flowers and never looked back. Opinions vary since so many flowering plants have yet to be discovered or named, but the Earth may hold at least 350,000 uniquely different species. Early insects that had fed on sap, leaves, and sugary exudates in the extrafloral nectaries of ferns, cycads, and their allies began to visit the earliest flowers in search of protein-rich pollen and sweet nectar. Unknowingly, in their search for food, these early flower-visiting insects became contaminated with and carried precious microscopic pollen grains. Pollinating animals became regular and dependable floral visitors, exactly the go-betweens that sessile plants required. This is the secret of flowers. They entice animals with their colors, shapes, and scents, then reward them with pollen, nectar, essential oils, resins, shelter, and even warmth. Flowers exist as living billboards, signaling to insects, birds, and bats, and sometimes us, for the sexual service of pollination they require. Flowers develop into fruits containing the seeds that become the next generation of plants and the basis of many human foods. We can't forget that the fruits and seeds of wildflowers, shrubs, and trees also feed many of the world's herbivorous wildlife, from Chesapeake Bay northern cardinals to African hornbills, along with fat bears, skunks, bats, and even crocodiles. This is the vital link between flowers and food for many animals, including us. Flowers and fruits are the basis for many medicines, while providing cotton, flax fibers, and beverages. Roses, jasmines, and ylang-ylang contribute their fragrant molecules as ingredients in the world's costliest perfumes. Cut flowers are a multi-billion dollar industry. It is becoming ever more apparent that we need flowers to maintain our health, our food supply, and for our happiness and mental abilities. Flowers also make us smile. They lift our spirits. Psychological studies indicate that floral scents may enhance long-term memory formation. But now we are losing many flowering plants to extinction before we even knew they existed. An estimated 68% of the world's flowering plants are now threatened or endangered. This staggering loss of diversity is due to anthropogenic causes, including habitat loss, degradation, and invasive species. Conversion of land for housing our ever-expanding human population and for new roads, mines, and farms erases wildflowers' living space and threatens yet more native plants. Invasive, weedy plants populate new areas, competing for space, light, and nutrients with those already growing there. It is these trends that are driving the massive loss of flowering species. And Stephen L. Buckman is an adjunct professor of entomology and evolutionary biology at the University of Arizona. He is the author most recently of The Reason for Flowers, Their History, Culture, Biology, and How They Change Our Lives. And now, A Terrifying Truth by David Lindorf. It wasn't too long ago that the death of socialism, the triumph of capitalism, and the end of history were widely hailed. What a difference a few years and a few fractions of a degree in the world temperature change makes. We may still be contemplating the end of history, but of a different sort. It is suddenly becoming painfully obvious that the pursuit of profit and the philosophy of growth for growth's sake and of dog-eat-dog is about to kill us all off. Now that it has been proven beyond any reasonable doubt that the Earth is headed for a global heat wave, the likes of which hasn't been seen in hundreds of thousands and perhaps tens of millions of years, the kind of killing heat that in the past has led to mass extinctions, it is ludicrous to talk about things like carbon trading and raising vehicle mileage standards. We need a revolution in the way we human beings live and the way we treat each other. There is no way that the world's 7.3 billion, latest count since July, and especially the estimated 2 billion of them who live in the wealthier societies, can continue to consume energy at even close to the level we have been consuming it. There is no way we in the developed world can continue to live in the way we have been living, in oversized houses, heated in winter and cooled in summer. There is no way in the Northern Hemisphere we can continue to have teakwood or mahogany-floored living rooms and eat strawberries in December. There is no way we can continue to squander trillions of dollars on war and military spending every year. No way, that is, if we plan on leaving a livable world for our children and grandchildren. The so-called green politicians who talk about instituting carbon trading schemes, about driving hybrid automobiles, about buying fluorescent light bulbs, and about turning down the thermostat and wearing sweaters are deceiving us or themselves. None of this is going to save us. What will save us is recognizing the age of consumer-driven capitalism is over. We either come up with a new way to organize society, in which production is based upon real needs, and in which scarce resources are made available to those who need them, not just to those who can afford them, or we will all be doomed, or at least our progeny. The peoples of the world, especially of the developed world, but really everywhere, need to recognize that unless our expectations are changed, unless our selfish desire for more is curbed, unless wasteful production is ended, we are all likely to be on that extinction list. So where are the leaders of boldness and vision in politics, media, and academia who are ready to tell the truth? Where are the peoples who are willing to listen to and reward that truth-telling? This is not an inconvenient truth we need to confront. It is a terrifying truth. We need to change everything, and we need to do it quickly. We need to end subsidies for agribusiness, which has virtually decimated local agriculture to the point that prime farm states like Pennsylvania and New Jersey now import all their food from the West Coast. We need to levy a massive tax on gasoline so that no one will buy cars, and so that those who have them will drive only rarely. Large, heavy vehicles for personal use should be outright banned. Trucks, too, should be heavily taxed, so that products will reflect the true cost of the environmental damage that shipping them around costs. Electricity and home heating fuels should also be heavily taxed, with some kind of a rebate program for low-income families so that people will stop heating and cooling large homes. As these things are done, there clearly will be mass dislocation. People who live in hot climes like Florida or Arizona will no doubt decide they can't afford to cool their homes and will move north. People in cold regions may decide it's too expensive to heat their homes and will move to more temperate zones. Companies like the Detroit automakers will go bust or shrink enormously. Power plants will be shut down. Oil companies will go bankrupt. That all has to happen, but it doesn't mean people have to starve. We as a society need to demand a government that will help those who are displaced by the crisis to relocate and to find new productive ways to earn a living. A huge government program of investment in alternative energy systems will be able to hire many whose jobs are lost by the shutdown of the carbon economy. A new ethos needs to be developed. Conspicuous consumption, egoism, and the so-called American dream of having it all for oneself and one's family need to be replaced with a new, actually a very old, concept, communalism. To succeed, we need to acknowledge that everyone is at risk, everyone is contributing to the common goal of survival, and everyone should and will be taken care of. The same approach needs to be taken in the larger world. If the poorer nations believe they are going to be abandoned to catastrophe and famine, they will do two things: continue to try and survive by the old strategies of wasteful energy use and environmental destruction and of mass migration to safer havens. The first response, for example, the continued destruction and burning down of rainforests for wood and cropland and ethanol feedstocks, will threaten us all with ever-worsening global warming. The second will lead to overcrowding of more fortunately situated nations and a drain on their resources. The only answer is again for all the wealthy nations and those that are better situated by geography to commit themselves to helping the more threatened nations and societies. This is not a matter of altruism. It is the simple logic of survival. But before we can start making the huge changes that are called for, really the dismantling of the whole capitalist system and the free market ethos, we need to start hearing and demanding to hear the truth from scientists, from politicians, from business leaders, from the media, and ultimately from ourselves. For starters, let's stop kidding ourselves that the latest United Nations report on climate change is the real story. That report, ominous as it sounds, doesn't tell the half of it. The report was first watered down by the scientists who reviewed it, and then it was censored by the governments that feared its findings. For one thing, it doesn't take into consideration the role that hundreds of billions of tons of methane gas underlying the Arctic and Antarctic permafrost, and trillions of tons of methane lying in the form of frozen hydrates deep under the ocean, could play if that super global warming gas should start pouring out into the atmosphere. We are in a situation where it is wholly inappropriate to act on optimistic assumptions. Rather, we need to consider worst-case scenarios and start planning and acting with those in mind. That means, for example, to keep the methane fiasco from occurring. We don't want the permafrost to go away in the polar regions. We don't want the oceans to warm precipitously, and we don't want the ice caps to melt away. That means we have to act much more dramatically than just worrying about coastal erosion and lowered crop yields. This is a crisis that is not going away. It is a crisis that is not going to be solved with Band-Aids. It is a crisis that is not going to be solved by smooth talk. And it is a crisis that will get worse the longer we take to recognize its true gravity and the longer we take to face up to the revolution that needs to take place if we are to prevent it. And that is the truth. And that was written by David Lindorf, who is a Philadelphia-based investigative journalist and columnist and a founding member of This Can't Be Happening, an online newspaper collective that proudly claims that it is, quote, the only news organization in the United States to be labeled a threat by the Department of Homeland Security. And now something I wrote, and something I have read in many different forms on this program, probably the latest a couple of months ago, Life in the Greenhouse, and of course my personal disclaimer holds. The funniest thing about choking on our affluence is that we think we are so smart. We think we have overpowered nature after centuries of pitiless struggle and are able to now crack the earth with our power. We don't want to give up the good life, the modern life of appliances and holographic reality. We ignore or trivialize warnings that we are fouling our nest, behaving with a false hubris of entitlement that regards humanity as Earth's only patron. Our long feast on Earth's flesh is giving us gas. Gaia's gas. Mother is biting back. Our proximity to extinction is not from any single cause or danger or combination of them, but because we seem so helpless to undo the damage or change direction. The byproducts of our ways of life are of less concern than our unwillingness to reverse their harm. Our doom will be the result of our lack of intelligent courage to face up to consequences. The terms are quite simple. If we have the moxie, we might survive. If not, we won't. Earth will abide whichever way we choose. We have built ourselves a global greenhouse and we dwell within. Greenhouse gases are emitted by human activity and magnify heat radiated back to Earth from an invisible ceiling structured by chemicals released by excessive use of fossil fuels, pesticides, and fluorocarbons that also eat away the upper-level ozone. Beloved Sol heats up our planet at the same time depletion of the ozone screen makes sunlight dangerous. The weather heats up in oscillating cycles of storms and droughts. Summers in particular are increasingly hot and dry, each summer the hottest recorded. Desertification is more rampant. Droughts are longer and more frequent, resulting in recurrent famine and intense wildfires. Contrarily, cyclonic and hurricane storms are more frequent, extensive, and increasingly violent. We have pummeled and plundered our home planet as if it offered an inexhaustible feast without change, without charge or cleanup, but the consequences of our careless and excessive self-indulgence are converging. So what can we do about our self-inflicted danger? What will we do about it? Our problems are so vast and complex, the solutions are nearly impossible to agree upon. Yet postponing answers and action leads almost always to denial and rejection of the problems, and thus their solutions. The consequences of our ways of life are of less concern than our unwillingness to reverse their harm. We have to stop abusing Earth, but we find infinite rationales for continuing to mutilate it. Tepid attempts to reduce climate-changing carbon pollution will only increase the onerous consequences of ultimate global warming. It is already necessary to cope with a hotter world, such as rising seas and abruptly varying weather patterns. More than anything else, the most immediate and necessary measure is a change of attitude. We simply have to stop abusing our scarred and sun-blistered Earth. And as an epilogue, again, something I wrote. Most adult human beings alive on planet Earth at this particular moment will most likely not suffer the severe ravages of worsening climate change, perhaps consoling themselves that they will be dead before it really kicks in. Yet perceiving death as the only escape is probably not a satisfactory consolation. And the prospect of each generation being aware the world will be more dreadful place to live in for each succeeding generation is not much of a consolation either. Although there is a tremendous political rift in the USA about global warming, we seem to harbor the world's majority of rabid climate change deniers, which includes the large cast of presidential candidates of the Republican Party, the real critical partisan divide might be between generations, the more passive elderly who will quit the planet soon, versus the young who want to reverse the probability of a harrowing future now, before it is too late. Another division is whether climate change is anthropogenic, human-caused, or simply recurrent natural cycle. So we have yet another United Nations conference on climate change, this time in Paris, another in a succession of failed conferences that are more or less the result of another great human schism, conceptual and personal, as well as geographical and societal, that between wealth and poverty. It would seem the main purpose of these conferences is the opportunity for those who cause and benefit most from environmental destruction of the planet to make certain the consequences fall upon those least responsible and who benefit the least. An inexcusable omission that goes beyond gaps between wealth, generations and geography is the failure to ensure an equal ratio between women and men as delegates to this climate change conference. Women's representation should have been a fundamental priority, not only in their presence, but in co-equal leadership with men, who are, after all, the major culprits responsible for the impending global disaster that threatens human continuance on this planet. It seems likely that women were the real pioneers of the cultivation of grains and domestication of animals that led to the agricultural revolution that produced civilization. The focal priority of this new century and millennium is to complete the public and personal equality of women. This transcends most other necessary reforms because it is the essential basic correction for humanity to make, as well as the most potent force to successfully fulfill the myriad other progressive changes, which indeed includes foremost the reversal of our present course toward extinction on planet Gaia. If we who are alive now do not sincerely sweat blood to mitigate this dismal trend, our climate distressed descendants will quite likely despise us for cravenly yielding to the short-term self-interest. They will probably wish an eternal hell for us to parallel their living hell on Earth. And this has been Michael McCusker. Happy Gaia.